Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Lila Azam-Zangane, and I'm the literary correspondent for Le Monde in New York. It is my great pleasure to introduce to you this evening Professors Umberto Eco and Pierre Bayard. Professor Eco, as we all well know, is a semiotician, medievalist, and author of the super blockbuster, The Name of the Rose. This past August, I visited Professor Eco in Milan for the Paris Review, and this is what I asked him and what he confessed to. "You are a great consumer of books," I said. "Yes, but I am not a glutton that swallows everything." "Have you read The Da Vinci Code?" "Yes, I am guilty of that." "So, do you generally have time to read the novels of your contemporaries?" "Not so much, because since I became a novelist, I discovered I am biased. Either I think they are worse than my novels, and I don't like it, or I suspect they are better than my novels, and I don't like it." But other than the fact that he is not reading them, Professor Eco is very optimistic about the future of our books. "Every season," he told me, "there is an article on the end of the novel, the end of literature, the end of literacy. The fact of the matter is, there are thousands of stores full of books and full of young people all over the world. And never in the history of mankind have there been so many books, so many places selling books, so many young people visiting these places, and so many people buying the books." Pierre Bayard, for his part, is a psychoanalyst and a professor of literature who just published a bestseller of his own, How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read. I have not read his book yet, but my sense is that it is a clever and witty opus concerned with the sociology of reading and non-reading as a creative practice. And Professor Bayard, as it turns out, devotes one full chapter to Umberto Eco, to The Name of the Rose, to the part where William of Baskerville demonstrates that he knows full well the substance of the second book of Poetics by Aristotle, which in fact he is picking up for the first time simply because he deduces it from the other Aristotelian pages. But then Bayard, in fact, has introduced false information about The Name of the Rose in his own chapter, which Eco admits not to have noticed, of which more later. Ladies and gentlemen, we are very happy to welcome you to Live from the NYPL, directed by the marvelous Paul Holdengraber. The mission of Live, do we still need to state it? To make the lions roar, to oxygenate the library, and bring great cultural conversation of international stature to New York City. So I would like to thank Bloomsbury Books and the cultural services of the French Embassy for their wonderful support, particularly Anne-Sophie Simnel and Violaine Huissement, who is not part of the cultural services, but who will be a French interpreter this evening. Thank you, Violaine. Our partners this season are Metro Newspaper, the media sponsor for the full live series, and 192 Books is our new bookseller partner. 192 Books is located at 192 10th Avenue. After the event, both Pierre Bayard and Umberto Eco have agreed to sign books. Please join them in the lobby. Also, please consider becoming a friend of the NYPL and receive discounts of all future live tickets in order to pull off speaking of many more books you have not read. Join the email list of Live from the NYPL and find out about upcoming events. This Monday, a conversation with Cees Nootboom, and on November 30th, Nicholas Kristof on Darfur. After tonight's conversation, Pierre Bayard and Umberto Eco have agreed to sign books. To sign books and to respond to questions. So a mic would be passed out. It would be great if you could wait for it to reach you since we're actually recording the evening. And it is now my pleasure to bring to the stage Pierre Bayard, Umberto Eco, Violaine Huissement, and Paul Holdengraber.
Thank you, Lila Azam-Zangane, for that wonderful introduction. Yes, the lion's roaring. So, I'm sorry about that. Things are falling out of my pockets before I even ask you a question. So,
why do you have a book on Pushkin?
Not Pushkin, Proust.
Ah, Proust. Okay.
On reading.
Okay.
Should I begin with Proust? No, I'll begin with Bayard instead. So Pierre Bayard, let me wonder first of all why you think so many people have come here tonight. What do you think they are hoping to get from you?
First of all, I should like to tell some words about my level of English. You will appreciate it's not quite good, but I will try to speak English. But I will be helped by Violaine to understand the questions and your commentaries, because I think in front of Umberto Eco it's better to be two, better to be one. And I like answering.
It's two against two.
Yeah. You are not the referee anymore.
No. Okay, now that I hear your English, it's two against two.
And I like avoiding questions, and I like answering beside the questions, but to answer beside the questions, it's necessary to understand the questions. So Violette will help me. Secondly, I like to be... I am in a strange state of mind in front of Umberto Eco, a kind of unheimlich state of mind.
Unheimlich is...
It's
uncanny.
No, I
uncanny,
know.
Uncanny.
I just thought we... I didn't bring the German translator.
Odd state of mind.
No. So, yeah.
Could you translate in both sides?
Yeah. Okay. So you're in an unheimlich state of mind.
Yeah. Unheimlich. Odd state of mind, because Umberto Eco lives in this book.
He lives in the book.
Yeah, he's a creature of this book. He's a character of my book in the third chapter of the first part. And so it's...
You have read this book, obviously.
Yeah, but I hope... it's strange for me to see... Excuse me, it's strange for me to see you here. Reminds me of this famous movie by Woody Allen, The Purple Rose of Cairo, where the actor on the screen looks in the audience, Mia Farrow, and he crosses the frontier between...
It happens also in Hell's a Popping.
Yeah. Right.
In Hell's a Popping, which they...
I'm sure you've never been likened to Mia Farrow.
Yeah. No, I was Mia Farrow in the comparison. it's in a way our language, complex language, we call that a metalepsis. It's when a character in a book crosses the frontier between fiction and reality and becomes an habitant of reality. So I am living a kind of metalepsis, and it's a strange impression for me.
And but we will get over that.
Now I answer your question. Why so many people, and why did I write this book? I was surprised to see that there was no book about this very common situation we know very often. And when we are intellectuals, this situation is quotidian. The situation of having to speak about books you have not read. And there is no book about it. You have books about everything, about improving your English. I should have read it. About taking care of your garden or how to kill your wife and so on. But no one's book about this common situation of having to speak about books, and we know the situation. You know it, Paul.
No.
But
you said intellectual.
So you are the exception, as Umberto Eco is the other exception. But
books he has read,
right, yeah.
Which is false, obviously. But let him.
But for each rule, there are exceptions.
Exception
which found the rule. So you are the first exception. Yeah, Umberto Eco is the second exception. In my life, I am always in this situation. So I tried to help people.
So is it a self-help book then?
First, self-help. Just the translation allows me to find the good solutions.
No, it's a scheme. Really, it's a strategy.
I was surprised, but in France, when the book was published, many people in many booksellers, you see, came to me and they told me thank you, because they have this kind of problem. They told me I begin at 9 o'clock, I end at 7. I don't have time to read, just few books a year, and each day people come to me and ask advices about books, and after having read this book, they are able to answer precisely.
So, in one of your chapters, you speak about how we should confront living writers, and I'm wondering, since I'm confronting two of you tonight. I'm wondering if you could give me some advice. I mean, I know that part of the advice you give is that I should flatter you.
Of course, but this first advice is well known. I give another advice. Because I had a very strange experience this year. A friend of mine who is a very famous writer in France, but I cannot give you the name. Okay. I was in a pub with him, and he explained me how much he loved my books. So it was a very narcissistic experience. I was happy, but I was only happy at the beginning of the encounter, because the more he spoke of my books, and the more I was terrified. I was more and more unsettled, because what he loved in my books did not overlap at all what I tried to do. So I give two advices in the book. First of all, you have to praise the writer. It was so great, extraordinary, he was to write this. But secondly, I think it's quite important not to be too precise, because if you...
So, I mean, give...
Keep on generalities, and I can explain why.
Yeah, help a little bit, because, I mean, yeah. Give me the words. I should have rehearsed this with you before we got on stage, but how should I have begun the interview tonight?
You can explain that this book transformed your life, for instance. No problem. But
this book
and my friend, the writer, began explaining me that my books transformed his life. So I was very happy. But afterwards, as he saw I was happy, he began to be precise. And the catastrophe began too.
I imagine that all of
you seem to be unsettled.
Well, no. I feel that this is very good advice, to be as general as possible and to evade as much as possible. That's what you're really suggesting, so that I should just say... But I can't say to you that your books have transformed my life and then say to Umberto Eco that his books have transformed my life. I have to have something else to say. So maybe I should say your books completely transformed the way I see reality.
Are you asking me?
No, I'm not asking you.
These books didn't transform my life, because I knew everything he was saying, and I completely agree. First of all, even though his book has three parts, and I agree with the first two parts, and I have some problems with the third one, but we speak later of that. The first part is what he said. Okay, consider the number of books published in the world and during the process of the evolution of mankind. The lifespan of a single person is not enough to read all of them. Okay, so we speak of a lot of books we have not read. Okay. And at the school, we study history of American literature, history of French literature, which means to be informed about books that we have not read and that we shall never read.
No, I mean, when we read these, we have these classes.
Anyway, Anyway, I have never read some masterpieces of Italian literature,
such as,
but I know more or less what they are about.
But admit at least to one of the books you have read.
Orlando Innamorato by Boiardo.
Really?
Okay. Never read. But as Bayard could say, I can, if not to make a complete lecture, at least to speak for 20 minutes about it, according to its relationship with Ariosto, with Tasso, because, as I said, what I have learned through other books is exactly the position.
Yeah.
You know, the, how do you say autodidacta, autodidacta? Les autodidacta.
Self-taught.
Self-taught people. There are certain people who are geniuses, but they have a weakness because they don't know how to put a certain book in the right place. Because school is exactly the institution that teaches you how to put that book. I have not read, as you have, but in that
place. No, so the school helps us greatly in those ways, yeah. Thank God we have the schools.
The institution that helps us not to read books, but I'm not joking. It's very...
Do you believe this?
It's very serious what I'm saying.
No, I know
what I'm saying.
I mean, we have these classes here, you know, at Columbia.
L'école, c'est l'institution qui nous permet de ne pas lire les livres parce qu'il nous enseigne où les placer.
Well, we need a translator I was just saying what I said before.
So.
Okay, no. So,
alors, je réponds en français, je fais ma propre traduction.
Non, c'est pas mal, mais il y a des cours ici, there are courses here at the university, at Columbia, you know, where you study... You take a course from Beowulf to Virginia Woolf, from from the Iliad to the Idiot.
Have you read
Beowulf? Not recently.
At the time of its publication.
Yes. I mean, it does remind me of a story that I've told before on this stage, but which I have to tell. I had a student at one of the universities where I taught who was very interesting and always said things that were slightly off. And it was wonderful to have him because he was very talkative. And, you know, sometimes I needed him to intervene. And we were reading Bartleby the Scrivener. And I turned to him, there were 100 students in the class, and I said, Michael, have you in fact read Bartleby the Scrivener? And he said, not personally.
That is very important. That's very important. Society and culture are a machinery by which and through which other people read for us. That's absolutely true and important. Otherwise, we will be all the Robinson Crusoe of literature. No, other people read for us. And
I decided, you know, in preparation for today, to actually read your book. And, you know, I wanted to prove it to you because I put a lot of, you know, post-its. I did that very quickly just before.
No proof.
And I underlined. I underlined in various places with notes. And but this brings me to something that your book, since you are a shrink, this brings me to something that your book does, stress, which is the role of shame. Shame is very important, a very important component of your book, and also fraud and being fraudulent, and the weight of culture. So maybe you could talk about shame, which I think isolates us in the world.
I will try to answer both to Umberto Eco and Paul. Of course, the school learns us to be able to locate books in libraries, but perhaps not sufficiently. What you have told Umberto Eco can be told by someone who knows this kind of keys. I think for many people, it's not evident that culture is a problem of locating books in the general libraries. I answer your question. When I was young, I was not in a family where there were many books. And to enter this country of books, this realm of books, this space of culture, for people who are outside is not evident, because we have a tendency in school and university in France to present books as a religious thing. A thing to worship.
What's wrong with that?
And but the result can be to terrify people. I was surprised by something in media last year and in conferences. After I spoke of my book, very often the journalist or the bookseller came to me and told a story. And it was always the same story. Of course, words could be slightly different. It was the same story in four parts. And the story was, when I was young, when I was at school, when I was, etc. First part. Second part, I was obliged to read Proust, to read James, to read Joyce, to read Umberto Eco, and so on. Third part, I did not succeed, because it was too difficult, it was too long, I disliked, etc. And so the result was that I stopped to read Proust, James, or this kind of book, or I stopped to read. And I heard many times this story, as if school and university created kind of slight wounds, injuries. Of course, it's not traumatism. But many people told me the same story, because we present book as if we were as if we had a very compact culture. And I think
so,
to explain
and
to...
So your goal is, instead of imprisoning people in a culture that they reject because they suffered such wounds in their years in school, your solution is just talk about books but don't read them.
Votre solution, c'est parler des livres, mais ne les lisez pas.
This is the counsel you're giving.
To be clear, it is the first book of a series. Of course, I will not give all the advices, because if I give all the advices, first of all, people will not buy the book, and secondly, I can write the following books, you see. You see what I mean? I try to open a new field of research. But as you told me, I really think there is a problem of guilt. And it's important to help people to lighten the burden of the guilt. It's not criminal to skim a book. It's not criminal to open a book and not finish it. It's not criminal to recognize you are not able to read Joyce or Proust.
But in certain situations, it sometimes is extremely complicated. I mean, I only have heard this said by other people, but in certain situations, one finds it very difficult to admit that one hasn't read Hamlet.
Never admit it.
So that, never admit it. Yeah. And you speak about this in your book, is that you have to find a way, I mean, you have to develop a very sophisticated way of being, you don't use the word, but nearly hypocritical or evasive.
But perhaps the situation is not the same in Europe and United States.
No, here we read most everything.
voilà. when I was in Paris last year, a Canadian friend told me, you are lucky in Europe because you can write books about the shame people feel when they have to speak about books they have not read. And he told me, in the United States or Canada, it's finished. Perhaps it's not the same situation. But I think the shame is identical, because we have this shame inside us. Whatever the
remorse.
Yeah.
Remorse.
Yeah.
Oui, yes.
And very few people in France will accept to recognize they have not read the works of the canon, because school infuses us this shame.
So we have to bluff. Bluffing is important.
Listen.
He is dealing with the third part of his theory. I would like to come back to the first part.
Please do.
We don't have read all the books we pretend to know, but we know them pretty well. I want to. I have a small library of no more than 50,000 books, and only 30,000 in my main apartment in Milan. And it happens to everybody when an idiot comes there. He says, "Oh, how many books have you read all of them?" So there are three standard answers. One was a friend of mine who said, "Many more, sir. Many more." The second is, "No. Why otherwise I should keep them here?" The third is, "No. The one I have read are at the public library. I give them. Those are the ones I have to read the next week." So they are destroyed. They vanish. Okay. But the second answer is the most serious. Why otherwise I would keep them there? A library is a guarantee for your memory. If you need something, you know it's there. But you are continuously ravaged by remorse. "I have not read that. I have not read that." Then, one day in your life, you pick up a book you had there since 30 years, and we were convinced not to have read it. You open it, and you realize that you know it perfectly. So there are three theories. One is a sort of occult theory. There is a sort of transpiration. No, you touch it, the animal spirits of the book enter. Yes. The second is that you believe not to have read it, but in the course of 30 years you have picked it up, you have opened, you have read two pages. The third is that in the course of those 30 years you have read many, many books who talked about that. And so at the final end, you discover that you know the book very well. So that is a way by which we know the content of many books we have not read. And that is a guarantee of knowledge and of advancement of learning.
You know, there's a fourth way of answering the question, which is the way I answered. I don't know how many books I have, but I know that I have 16,000 pounds of books, because when we moved here from Los Angeles, the president of this library called me up and said, "You know, it's wonderful you're coming, but, you know, we got the estimate for your move, and there's, you know, it's quite heavy, the amounts of books you're bringing." And in a moment of humor, he said to me, "You know, I just want to tell you that..."
That's why I wanted my daughter to be an architect, to calculate the possibility.
The president said, "You know, I just wanted to let you know that we actually have books here." Which I thought was, you know, rather shrewd. But when people come to my home and people ask me if I've read every book, I always say immediately twice. It's another answer.
That's the fourth one.
That's the fourth one. Now, I'd like everybody...
My answer to this question, because we all know this story of someone who goes to a flat and is astonished. My answer is, I did not read them, but I live with them. And what you perfectly describe is the story of a man who lives with books. And perhaps it's what school does not teach, that it's not a problem of reading or not reading, it's a problem of living with books. It's quite different. It looks like, but it's quite different, because it means sometimes you don't read the book, it means you begin and not finish, but you know the book is here. And when you have a problem, you can go to him and ask advice to this book, such as a companion. That's a great difference, and I think school should teach this difference between to read and to live with.
School should teach that culture doesn't mean to know the date of the death of Napoleon by heart, but to be able to find it in 3 seconds. while usually school teaches people that they have to know it by heart.
Now, Professor Bayard, you have here at the start of your book, and I've given it to everyone here in the audience and above, and I want to say hello to all the people who are watching us on simulcast, a list of abbreviations, which, you know, seems fairly serious. A list of abbreviations: opsit, work cited, ibid, ibidem, UB, book unknown to me, SB, book I have skimmed, HB, book I have heard about, FB, book I have forgotten, plus, plus, extremely positive opinion, plus, positive opinion, minus, negative opinion, minus, minus, I mean, we could continue, obviously, extremely negative opinion. Could you explain to us a little bit what the purpose of this was? And I know that some books, in particular, for instance, if we take Les Illusions Perdues, a book by which most everybody here may have read it at some point, by Balzac, Lost Illusions, it is both SB, if you could follow, please, SB, HB, and FB, but only plus. I mean, so it's many things at the same time. Could you tell us what the use of this classification, this taxonomy might be?
In this book, I try to be frank and honest with myself. For each book I quote in my book, I precise with the abbreviation if it's a book unknown, a book I have skimmed, a book I have heard about, or a book I have forgotten. And of course, these categories can overlap. You can precise, I also give the feeling I have about the books I have not read, and I put two plus if I have a good opinion.
What is the criteria of a good opinion? I'm just curious. I mean, how do you decide this? I mean, I'd like to learn from you.
No, it's just a feeling, and of course it can change. But what is important in this list is not these categories, but the categories which are not in the list. Because you can find other categories. For instance, 3 days ago I was in Harvard, and Homi Bhabha proposed me a new category. He proposed the books on which you sleep. I think it's a good idea, and I take it. And now I will precise in next edition with a footnote for Homi Bhabha. Because what is important is that there is not the category read books and the category unread books. Because we often consider there is a kind of a straight line, frontier between read books and unread books. Sometimes this distinction can be useful, but for many books, as Umberto Eco told, we are not in this distinction. For many books, we are not able to tell if we have read them or not. For many books by Hegel, Lacan, Freud, frankly, I can't tell. Perhaps I read them some years ago.
Read them twice and another.
Yeah. Because
so you haven't
it's quite them. Important not to forget the role of oblivion, forgetfulness. I look like Montaigne.
Yes,
Montaigne
yes.
has a very bad memory. He forgot everything, the name of people, the faces, the books he had read, the books he had written. And I am in the same situation. And when people ask me, did you read this book? I am not able to answer this question. So what is important in this list is the fact that I did not use two categories, read books and unread books. And after, new categories will be introduced in next terms, of course.
But this is the second. I told this book is to be divided in three parts. This is the second one. Okay, we have read a lot of books, but it doesn't mean we are remembering them perfectly. And that's a very important remark. I could ask my audience, do you remember in War and Peace by Tolstoy the moment in which Natasha marries Prince Andrei? And a lot of you said, ah, yes, but no. She never married Prince Andrei because he died before. But it's not so easy to die. I am not sure that everybody of you was remembering exactly that Natasha didn't marry Prince Andrei. And Bayard, in his books, makes the analysis of three books. One is By the Name of the Rose, the one is David Lodge novel, and the other is
Graham Greene.
There are three books about the understanding of unread books. And at the end, he says, I made the trick. I inserted in the summary of the three books a mistake, a false. Personally, I detected immediately the mistake for Graham Greene and for David Lodge, and they didn't detect. I didn't detect the mistake for my book. So you see that our way to remember books is very adventurous, and that is an absolutely important point, in which I appreciated very much his book.
I saved the
his book that I don't remember exactly, but
I saved the Abbey of Melk from burning because I think you could not destroy this abbey, and we'll have to discuss about this point. But I am sure it was not destroyed. And so now the abbey still exists.
So to come back to Montaigne, which is...
That is another story, is the possible worlds created by books that they are still there, but as another... sorry. Another evening, next year. Yes.
Are you coming back?
Yes, yes.
Well, thank you.
So but there are other mistakes in the book. You found three mistakes, but there are other mistakes. I had decided when I began to write books never to speak about living writers because I think it's too dangerous. I have a family, children, and business, etc. And for the first time, I spoke about two living writers, Umberto Eco and David Lodge. You appeared in the circumstances I have described, and David Lodge wrote a letter to me to explain I had made a mistake about his book. So now I return to the old situation. I will never speak anymore of living writers. It's too dangerous.
But that's curious that David Lodge wrote a beautiful essay on the name of the rose and he didn't detect the mistake.
Because I suppose he skimmed and he went directly to the chapter devoted to him and he found the mistake and let.
Writers do that sometimes.
Yeah, it's a true story, yeah.
Can I come to the third part?
You may,
because
but
I have some question for him.
But before you come to it, may I do
you
something?
You are the master, puppet master.
Thank you. Thank you. No, I've never been defined so beautifully. You put a quotation that has intrigued a lot of critics and alleviated a lot of guilt for these critics who are paid to review your book. And as you know, your book has been reviewed a lot, I must admit, mostly favorably by the critics. And you put this quotation of Oscar Wilde that is quite wonderful, and we recognize Wilde immediately, don't we? I never read a book, I must review it, prejudices you so. It is beautiful.
It's very important for a university professor when he's a judge in a commission for chairs. Never read the publication, otherwise you could be influenced by them.
Yes. Absolutely. No, I remember a professor of mine who said, you know, when he was asked if he had read a book, he said, read it, I haven't even taught it. I mean, so, you know, there are these various ways of but let's come back to Oscar Wilde, because it's a wonderful quotation, and I'd like you to to talk a little bit about how Wildian it is.
I see
what you mean. We might turn to the end of your book.
I had a problem with this quotation too, because I was very happy when I met this quotation. And you see, I'm a naive person. I trust people. If Umberto Eco explains me psychoanalysis is just a fake, I stop practicing psychoanalysis.
What do you think?
It's a fake.
It's a fake. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So I stop.
You have more time to devote yourself to writing the second volume.
I am just as Woody Allen in The League. I identify to a person and I follow the advices. And when Alberto Manguez writes in A History of Reading, Oscar Wilde told that, I quote Alberto Manguel, and I really thought it was Oscar Wilde's quotation because he told, and it was not true. And
so
a reader.
Just before you get to that, the question of authority is very important, and you speak about this in the book. Alberto Manguel, in The History of Reading, says, this is Oscar Wilde. You, as obviously a very naive person, say, this is Oscar
because
Wilde.
Because I am an autodidact. I come from the milieu I explain you. So I respect and worship great professors. And so when Alberto Manguel told this quotation was from Oscar Wilde, I believe
beautifully
it. And it was not from Oscar Wilde. It was from Sidney Smith. And so I put a footnote to explain the problem. And I told me this. Perhaps Sidney Smith was the first to tell this. But is it possible to be sure that Oscar Wilde never said that?
He said so many things.
Perhaps it could.
Listen, stop talking.
Listen, when writing my doctoral dissertation on the Aquinas aesthetics, I was immediately faced with the fact that all the literature on the subject, centuries of literature, said that Aquinas said that pulchrum est id quod visum placet. It's not necessary to translate it. That was that definition. Then I discovered that he had never said so. Never. He had said something different. Pulcra dicuntunque visa placet. And the entire posterity continued to discuss about that definition, taking it seriously, and he never wrote it. Is the same history of elementary, my dear Watson. Conan Doyle had never written this line. And the entire Conan Doyle posterity is playing upon elementary, dear Watson. Sherlock Holmes never said elementary, my dear Watson.
I mean, people can have tenure for years based on falsity.
Yes. Oh, and Aquinas never said elementary there was.
I'd like to end the story, but so when I saw my problem, I decided to trust. Umberto Eco was not in Paris, I could not ask. So what did I? I went to Google. And I put the quotation, and the answer of Google was Oscar Wilde, Oscar Wilde, Oscar Wilde, Oscar. Because my book was successful, so many journalists took the quotation, and now it's an Oscar Wilde quotation. It's considered
but maybe
by everyone.
It is. Maybe it is, in a way.
Perhaps.
But he said.
I am unable.
I mean, he said so many things. But you know what is interesting is a note you put. I'll read it. It says, "Quoted in Alberto Manguel, A History of Reading, HB plus plus
plus plus." Yeah. I subtract one plus because he mistake and it causes much trouble to me.
Now?
Only one plus now.
HB plus, so next edition HB plus. This remark is also attributed to the British writer Sidney Smith. And you know what is interesting? Is the New York Times book review of this Sunday, you will be already in France, has a letter from a reader who corrects you about this quotation. And what I found fascinating about that is that obviously that reader didn't get much beyond the first page. Because if they had gotten beyond, they would have seen this footnote.
Because
vous l'avez pris au piège.
Yeah,
you got that reader.
And there are quotations.
I mean, it's mean of you.
And there are quotations you can never find again the author. There is one of them that I find marvelous, and I used it as an excerpt in one of my books. I used to be perplexed, but now I am no longer sure of it.
Marvelous. And who is it?
Finally, I found that it's a certain Bosco Perciu, quoted by a psychologist without any precise reference, but I find it marvelous. I used to be perplexed, but now I'm no longer sure of it.
And you know, the thing is, and to some extent, and then maybe we'll come to the inner library and the relationship to books that you think we should entertain with books. But for a very long time, one can live with quotations like that. I mean, I suffer from quotomania myself, and very often I feel as though I've quoted something so many times, and I'm convinced it is by that person. Nobody has, for instance, corrected me on my favorite line from Oscar Wilde. I mean, Wilde is wonderful in this way. He said, it is only superficial people who do not judge by appearance. I mean, it may be by Wilde, it may not be.
But maybe this quotation is correct in your wildest desires.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And thank you for that. But I mean, what I would like to talk about with you is maybe you've created a new taxonomy, new concepts, and one of them, maybe we can move in that direction and then get to the third part too, is the notion of the inner library. It's a perfect place to speak about it.
I try to invent some new concepts to describe our unconscious relationships to books, and I invented three types of books: screen book, for example, inner books, and ghost book. One main important notion is a screen book. I try to explain that when we have the feeling we are speaking of the same book, very often it's not the same book, because we replace the book we are speaking of by another one. It's easy to make an experience. Go to a movie or a book of your childhood, a movie or a book you cherished, you loved very much, but you have not read the book or seen the movie for years. Go and see it. Or read it, and you'll be surprised, because it's not the book or the movie you had in your head. And the most important scenes for you are not in the book or in the movie.
Where are they?
It's a good question, but it's...
You put them aside.
It is a screen books, and its substitution shows how much unconscious is involved in our relationship with books.
For a psychoanalyst, it's la tarte à la crème.
How would you say la tarte à la crème in English?
A pecan pie.
A pecan pie?
C'est tarte à la crème.
But I think it's important, because when we are discussing of a book, the same book, if you study with attention what happens, it's not the same. I devoted a book to Hamlet, and the problem of the dialogue of death, and you know Hamlet is probably the book about most critics wrote, and when you study very precisely what happens in discussions about Hamlet, you discover the persons don't speak of the same. Even when speak of the same excerpt, of the same page, they don't speak of the same.
But this is a good thing.
I think it's unavoidable. It's difficult to avoid it. And it's why the notion of read books is probably not a good notion to understand what happens.
I mean, I've noticed in your book, whenever you use the word read book, you do something that one does a lot in this country, in America. You may not be aware of it, but when people want to be ironic in this country, very often they go like that, you know. But you write the word read in quotation marks. Why that distancing? Because what does it mean to have read a book?
I heard very often a joke about this book. Many journalists told, I am going to speak of this book, but I have not read it. Or they spoke of the book and they ended the article by saying, I have not read it.
No, I wrote that you had not read it.
No, it was a difference. But what does it mean? I told to some journalists who explained me they had not read the book, what does it mean? The same journalist who explains me he has not read the book begins to speak about his childhood and the complex relationships he had with the school and so on. It means there is a work inside him which has begun. So what does it mean to have read a book if just with the title or the cover or skimming you have begun to reflect on important problems such as your childhood or your inner suffering? You see, to have read a book is not clear for me. I'm not able for many books to explain if they must belong to this category or the contrary category, you see.
So what is the importance of skimming? This is something that critics in this country have been insisting on, I think with some relish, because you've kind of helped them along. You've said that skimming is really a very important attribute of reading.
Certain books are written just in order to make the reader to skim a lot of pages. I make always the example of the great masterpiece of Italian literature of the 19th century, the I Promessi Sposi by Manzoni. There is, immediately after the first chapter, a long 20 pages of documents of the epoch in order to explain what the bravi that were contractors of the time were. And everybody confessed not to have read all the pages. That's exactly what Manzoni wanted. He wanted people to understand that they were losing a lot of time in discussing that. Skip it. Then, when you read it at the second time, and the third time, you come back.
And you skip.
But for the beginning, okay, and the author knew it, encouraged you to do that.
That's one form of skimming. But you talk about skimming in a slightly different way, I think.
If you go to a French library, sit in a French library such as the great library of Tolbiac, and you have students in front of you, they will begin, most of them, will begin on the first line and on the last line. And I think there is a deep relationship between the refuse of skimming, because it's not allowed for young people, and how French libraries. When I come to the United States, the first thing I do is to go to libraries, because it's a space of pleasure. Why? When you're in France, if you need a book, you go, you give the title of the book, and you receive the book you had come to read. If you go to the United States, you can make promenades inside the libraries and wanderings and walking. You go to search a book and you look at the books.
Afterwards. You have written about the difference.
It's a kind of skimming.
Open shelves.
Yeah.
And I think there is a deep relationship between this difference inside of libraries and our practice. I think we should teach our students to skim. Of course, it cannot be the only way to the books. It's important to read books from the first line to the last line, but we intellectuals were obliged to skim to make research, you see.
Professor Bayard, just hold the thought for 1 minute. I'd like to say to my staff here if they could make the room a bit warmer. It feels quite, I thought, our conversation would heat things up enormously, but somehow we haven't quite achieved that. So if this room could be made a bit warmer, that would be really wonderful. I mean, I know that by having it so cold, I'm preserving you for a bit longer, and this will give you the opportunity to read more books.
Keep cool.
Keep cool, yes.
Keep cool.
Exactly. But if we could just make it a bit warmer, I would appreciate it by at least 2 or 3 degrees. Maybe 4 even. Why not? You talk about the necessity of abstinence, of actually...
Sexual abstinence?
Well, you know, your book never mentions sex.
I've forgotten my book, but... Well.
No, but you do talk about the ability... It's very hard not to read certain books and not to read. But you encourage people, and you. I think you use a few examples... from some writers, I'm trying to remember now who they are. You see, I read the book yesterday and I've already forgotten. But you speak about abstinence and the necessity of abstinence. And are you lost?
I can
find the passage for you. It's on page 13, if you'd like to go to that page, please.
We live to remember it, but it doesn't exist in the book.
There is an author, page 13. Ah, yes.
Yeah, you see it? You see it?
Where?
You see it, Muzil. Ah, you say, the second case, a person not reading abstains like Muzil's librarian. And you talk about, abstinence comes up a few times in the book. And I'm wondering if you could talk about sort of reminds us of St. Augustine, give me continence, but not yet.
I find it a very beautiful story by Muzil, the story of this... bibliothecaire,
librarian
who decides to stop reading because he wants to have a general perspective on all the books of his library. Of course, it's humorous from Muzil, but I think it's also a story with wisdom, and because a cultural man has this perspective. The kind of perspective you can get when you wander through American libraries. And this is the meaning of abstinence. But of course, I don't recommend abstinence. What I'd like to defend is the necessity for people who are outside the world of culture to know different ways to the books. I think very often school teaches one way to reading. It's a respectable way to read from the first line to the last line. But we know other ways of reading because we know books. We are in this world of culture. We know the keys. And I think we should teach the keys.
And you make a distinction, a very important one, I hope you'll recognize this one, between active and passive reading.
Yeah, I explain sometimes, I have in library a student in front of me, and it's quite different. Someone does not read can be quite different from someone who does not read. Because you have a way of non-reading, which is just absence of reading, and you have a way of non-reading, which is a step to this perspective Musil teaches, you see. No, you don't see, but I don't see either, Doc, so it's not...
Do you see?
No, but it's another...
I
was always
thinking about the third part.
The third part.
You don't listen what I say.
I have since a long time, elaborate a theory in many books about interpreting and using a book. And somebody has thought that I was privileging interpreting against using. No. There are two ways of approaching a book. I always tell the story of my doctoral dissertation. I went to a point in which I couldn't go forwards. It happens when we make a research. I was completely lost. And at the Bouquiniste in Paris, I found an old book of the 19th century of a certain Abbé Vallée. I read it. It was very boring. It was on the subject matter of my dissertation, obviously. But at the page 133, I found the real idea that settled everything. And I remember to have under stressed it with the red pencil.
That was so, your copy, not the library.
No, no, my copy. And so I finished my word. And then it's why, if somebody remembers here, at the beginning of the name of the rose, I quote a certain Abbé Vallée, because I always worshipped that Abbé Vallée who solved my problem. And once a friend of mine said, but you invented Abbé Vallée, it didn't never exist. I swear. And I went to look for the book. It was now on the upper shelves, and I picked it up. I remember exactly the page with the right sign and the red sign, and I found it. And the Abbé Vallée was not saying what I believe to have found in me. He was saying something else. Simply by reading it, I got my idea. Well, that is why what I call to use a book. It happened also yesterday. I was reading a book before sleeping at a certain point. I interrupted it. I followed my train of thoughts that was inspired by a single sentence of that book, but then I followed a person. So
What was it yesterday?
Oh, a book of a friend of mine teaching mathematics at Harvard on the Foucault's pendulum, but the real one, not my own. Okay. So we use books. We can read a poem and then to fancy of our beloved. We can do everything. And this is the way defended by Bayard when he says the French school exaggerated in analyze the text to be obliged to know everything about a given text. Let the students be free not to read the book, but to invent the book they are reading or not reading. But that's to use books. On the other hand, we have to interpret books. And I think that...
But for that, we need to read them.
Our life, we can use a lot of books. But there are at least a few books that we must really interpret. I quoted War and Peace. And I said that maybe a lot of you didn't remember whether or not Natasha married the Prince Andrei. But the greatness of War and Peace is that she didn't. Is the lesson of destiny. Dealing with a book, you cannot invent it. You cannot think that Pierre Bezukhov killed Napoleon as he wanted. He didn't. So you must surrender to the majesty of destiny. And that is a great lesson. And in order to do that, you have to select in your life few books that you must read completely and interpret faithfully without inventing and without falsifying them. I am sure that Bayard is of my own opinion and he has his own book that he really interprets instead of using them. But I want to stress that important difference. Otherwise, there will be a sort of Stanley Fisher or American deconstructionist position by which you can do everything you want of a book. Yes, you can be everything you want. You can also wrap the pages and put inside the salami and things like that. But books must be respected sometimes in their own.
There are many important points in what Umberto Eco told. First of all, I think it's quite important to explain to the students what you did. When we create, when we practice researchers, it's a succession of problems and difficulties and lacks and holes. I think it's quite important to transmit it. Secondly, as you told, in France there is something which is a catastrophe for me. It's what is called book report, and it's a main exercise in the schools. book reports. It's some kind of summary and very precise analyze question.
Text,
no, no, it's not analyze the text. No, no, analyze the text is not a catastrophe. Book report,
you talk about it with your son. Who's
yeah, in my family, I'm in charge with book reports because we have we share activities
them.
And yeah. I cook and I practice book reports.
At
And book reports, you have to summarize the book you have read very precisely, and you have to answer very precise questions.
Like?
What's the name and first name of all the characters, and in which town the hero came through, and you have to reconstitute the fabula very precisely. And
what's wrong with that? I mean, it is important to know the characters of the book you're reading.
Sometimes I'm not able to answer the questions in this book report about books I have written on. It's because they are so precise, it's impossible. And once my son told me, after we had made a book report, it disgusted me from reading. And why? There is all a representation of reading behind this book report. It's just as if reading was a kind of scientific enregistrement?
Recording.
Recording. The real reader does not proceed in this way. Sometimes he read the book and was fond of the book. He's unable to give all these informations because he dreamt, he imagined, and he stopped to see a girl in the street, and so on. That is reading, not what we call, what we teach in schools, you see. And last point, of course, I agree with Umberto Eco about the fact that some books have to be read from the first line to the last line. Of course, it's evident I am not an adversary of books. All my life is about books, and I've. But you have a very important.
He even read mine.
Well, let me say
I prefer we change the subject, if it's possible.
let's say something about that, because when Pierre Maillard knew that you were going to be on stage with him, he said to me that he was rereading your oeuvre complète, your complete works, according to his very particular methodology.
Oui, but in the Bayard method.
La méthode Bayard.
What I like to say is that this distinction, which is quite important in your books, between interpretation and use, it's a problem for me. Why? Of course, at a conscious level, it's possible. But at an unconscious level, it set me a problem. Why? Because if I accept this distinction, it's as if you gave me a saw, a hand saw, and you proposed me to saw the Freudian branch on which I am sitting. And I am not a masochist. And so I cannot accept this distinction between, for me, when you read, unconscious is dominant. But of course, at a conscious level, I agree with your distinction between interpretation and use.
I have not the same problem because I am sitting under the tree and not on the Freudian branch.
Wait, but I will fall on you if you saw the branch.
I know that interpretation and use are two idealtypen, two ideal positions, and then in life there is a continuous flow between the two, and sometimes we cannot distinguish if we are making interpretation or use. But, you know, at least I read Sylvie by Gérard de Nerval 40 years, every time discovering something new, and then finally I translated it. Maybe I am wrong, but I believe to have interpreted it, not used it. Maybe it was a wrong interpretation, but it was a sort of interpretation, and I felt bound to a duty of faithfulness toward the book, toward the text. Maybe it happens a few times in one's life.
Because one can't fall in love with so many things simultaneously.
No, it happens a few times to really read A books, but sometimes it happens happily. And all the rest, once somebody told me that my standard should be I can't be can't.
I think I completely agree with that.
You don't have to, though. I mean, you.
Vous
n'avez pas besoin d'être d'accord.
Okay. But on this point, there is no problem. I think if we could teach to the students and children that some books will play a determinable place, role in their life, that should be a good introduction.
But Oscar Wilde had a different view. No, in your book, you talk about.
I quote many writers in this book who have paradoxical positions, but
and Wilde wanted to come up with 100 books.
Yeah, and they explain they never read, they hate reading, and the less you read, the best you are.
Mais
but of course, it's
Wilde
a kind of humorous position.
Wilde, you say in your book, was asked to give 100 books one shouldn't read.
On devrait demander aux gens de donner 100 livres qu'on ne devrait pas lire.
But for everyone knows Oscar Wilde, such as Valérie and other people, were voracious readers.
But this is where
course.
The problem comes up with you, right? Because you're claiming on the one hand that we can talk about books we haven't read, and on the other hand, you give very good and detailed analysis of some of the writers. And so you're caught in a paradoxical situation of, on the one hand, telling us that you needn't know about the writers, on the other hand, giving us a sense, maybe you're just bluffing, that you, in fact, have read these books.
No, I don't think the objection is good. He says that there is a lot of books that we don't read, but we can speak of them, and then in his life he read some books.
Really?
So there is nothing strange.
Okay.
Nothing strange.
There's no paradox, actually.
He didn't read Joyce, but he read me. Okay. I appreciate it. I appreciate it very much.
No, I think, you know, I mean, you have to choose carefully.
My books are not written by myself.
Not what?
Are not written by myself. But my books are written by a kind of narrator, you see, a character who explains his positions. This character is not me, it's a part of me. If you are a novelist and you create a murderer, Umberto Eco did it with Jorge. He's sure Jorge killed, but I'm not sure. But when you create a murderer, you are not this murderer, but this murderer is a part of you, you see. It's exactly what I try to practice in my books. All my books are written by a kind of paranoiac narrator. But of course, I am not this paranoiac narrator. I'm not completely this paranoiac narrator. Everyone who is used to books immediately sees the book has been written by someone who is obliged to read. You know, I had to read dozens and dozens of books to write this one. Why? To find examples. They are very rare. There are very few books where people speak about their practice as reading. So I had to read much and much. And this narrator, this voice, who introduces the book is not me, it's a part of me. And in France there was misunderstandings because some journalists did not perceive the fact and the theory was inside fiction. And they attacked me very widely.
What was the reception of the book in France?
It was very good. But some journalists began to attack me because they really thought I had decided to create a kind of international movement to preventing people from reading. And they explained, but you don't realize the situation of books in France. Our children don't read anymore. And now Bayard wants they stop to read. Of course, it's absolutely absurd. This book has been written by someone who loves books. Books are my life. It's evident. But I insist on the point that it is a fiction and there is a narrator, paranoiac narrator, who is a part of me, an important part of me, but only a part. So you have differences of levels. Some sentences overlap what I think, and some sentences don't look. In France, in the fourth page, you have a sentence which is, if you want to speak of a book accurately, first you have not to have read it, and you have to speak it to, with someone who has not read this book either. And people really thought it was my opinion. I feel angry about people who are not able to distinguish levels of language and to see the humorous part in a book, you see. So it explains the differences. Of course there are differences, because there are many Pierre Bayard in the books. More than two.
Case of split personality.
No, but in United States, split person, in France, split personality are only 2%. In United States, sometimes 20, 24, because the United States is a large country.
No, no, but at the time, au temps de Charcot, il y avait plusieurs personnalités.
Yeah, United States, inside one personality, you have the grandfather, the grandmother, the sisters, the brother, and everyone speaks
to you about the Graham Greene story, The Third Man. Because we find ourselves a little bit in this situation now. You might narrate it a little bit for this audience.
It's one of the stories I had when I began. When I began the book, when I had the idea and I found the title, I only had three stories and I had to find the others. And I found it was really a beautiful story. It's The Third Man by Graham Greene. The novel, the story is quite different in the movie by Carol Reed. And the hero, the name is Buck Dexter. He's a writer, a kind of writer. He writes Western books.
Popular novels, books, yes.
He doesn't get a very high marking.
And he has to give a conference in Vienna, but he's confused with another writer who is named Dexter, but Benjamin Dexter. And Benjamin Dexter belongs to a very elitistic literature. It's a kind of Henry James. So Buck Dexter gives a conference to an audience, which is very happy to meet Benjamin Dexter. And so it's a perfect dialogue of the day.
Not only, but they ask him about Gray. Gray and Mix, they were intending Gray, the pre-romantic poet,
yeah.
and the things of Zane Gray, the Jack London-like.
When Bud Dexter speaks of Gray, for him, it's the famous Gray who wrote Western novels, but for the audience, is a poet Gray. You see, and it's a perfect dialogue of the deaf. But I think this dialogue shows with caricature what happens when we speak of books, and shows something which is quite interesting. It's the role of power relations. Because, strangely, Buck Dexter does not understand the questions.
No, I mean, I'd love to, forgive me for interrupting you, because the quotation you use here, which I do believe is from Graham Greene, you, at least you quote it that way.
Which page?
This is page 66.
66, yeah.
Of How to Talk About Books You Haven't Read. To make matters even worse, Martins is not dealing with just any group of readers. He's giving a lecture, much like we're here in this auditorium, but with a circle of admirers, literary enthusiasts of his, in quotation mark, works, who delighted finally to have Dexter at their disposal and eager to pay homage, cannot resist showing off by asking highly specialized questions. A kind-faced woman in hand-knitted jumper said wistfully, "Don't you agree, Mr. Dexter, that no one has written about feeling so poetically as Virginia Woolf? In prose, I mean." Crabbin whispered, the man was next to him, you might say something about the stream of consciousness." "Stream of what?"
What is quite interesting is that although Dexter does not understand the questions, because he does not know Virginia Woolf, he does not know Joyce, he's perfectly enabled to speak about the stream of consciousness, everything is all right. Why? Because he is considered as a great writer. And the
he's
more...
Invited.
Yeah,
he's
invited. Invited, and the great writer, and a great writer can so, I mean, be I've paradoxal, and so on.
And I've noticed that here, you know, yeah. I can invite people here, and simply by the fact of them being here, they respect
And when he says, when someone asks, what do you think of James Joyce, James who? It is considered really as the great writer who is able to have this kind of attitude, you see. And it shows there are, when you speak of a book, of course there is the book, but there is also a complex context of power relationships which are at stake. And it's what I try to explain about this experience.
And it's an experience that happens quite often. There's a story about Irving Berlin and Isaiah Berlin. Isaiah Berlin was, there was a confusion. Winston Churchill thought that he was inviting Isaiah Berlin, but in fact he was inviting Irving Berlin. And so he was asking Irving Berlin about the state
of... White Christmas.
Yeah, and he said, you know, what is there going to, you know, what is your biggest contribution? And he spoke about White Christmas.
But Isaiah was a good singer. He sang perfectly, so he could have played the role of Irving.
But seriously...
I'm sure Umberto Eco can tell us what he wants about Saint Augustine or Saint Thomas, because he is Umberto Eco. Everyone will appreciate what he says. It's quite important. Even if he took the sentences in Proust or Mickey Mouse.
You mean just simply being Umberto Eco is enough?
Yeah, of course. It's what happens exactly in the Graham Greene's novel.
But why Dexter in the movie was called Alga Martin? The name of the writer in the movie was different than in the novel. Why?
No, I simplified the story. The name is the same. The name is Rollo Martins, and his name Rollo Martins in the movie and in the novel.
No, but Rollo in the novel, but Alga in the movie.
There is something wrong.
The same movie. Maybe you are thinking of the Potemkin.
Anthony Hopkins movie.
No, I don't remember. Right, let's check.
No, it's interesting.
It doesn't change.
But Buck Dexter is his name as a writer. It's a comment du surnom, pseudonym. Buck Dexter is pseudonym. But in the movie, they suppressed the sequence. It's quite different. The real and beautiful scene
Even in the movie, there is a certain tension. This scene in which the poor one is unable to face the situation is very untenable.
It must be anxiety,
full of tension. Yes.
Of course.
But it can make a difference because probably you first read the novel and then saw the movie, and I first saw the movie and then I read the novel.
But this is an issue that Pierre Bayard doesn't bring up, but it's
terrible
a
issue. Yes, yes.
Terrible because
I have stopped every possible translation of my novels into a movie after I was told that a girl entering a bookstore said, "Oh, They already transformed the movie into a novel." Stop.
I laugh with delay because I need translation.
No, I mean, the other day this was happening when I was interviewing Peter Nadas. There were 100 Hungarians here. Peter Nadas is a Hungarian. And all the Hungarians were laughing before, you know, I understood what the novelist was saying to me. It's a situation which can be very confusing. To now come to, I think, an issue which is quite serious in your book.
Yeah, let us try to be serious. Yeah?
Just for a moment, Professor, is that you talk about the dangers of reading. And... I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on this, and then since I did bring Marcel Proust, I would like to, in conclusion, end with a line by Proust. You talk about the fact that maybe we should be cautious and not read too much.
It's Oscar Wilde who says that. Of course, at a first level, it's humorous. But a second level, perhaps it's not so humorous. Many people, many writers, many creators, read in a movement of creation, which has as a result then they cross the book. I think it's Oscar Wilde and other people, such as Paul Valéry, try to explain. It's not only a humorous sentence.
But you see, I mean, the dangers of reading. I'll read this line by Proust because I'd like you to comment on it. It's in a preface that Proust wrote on a text of Ruskin on reading. And Proust wrote a text on reading of Ruskin. And he, so it's a meta-text.
Oh, finally, that's why you have this book.
Oh, you think I just had it to impress people?
You have prepared the question before. Yes.
Well, you know, improvisation is something you prepare. So, this is what he says, and I think Pierre Bayard...
There was only one mark in the book.
Well, it's the only page I read.
Okay.
But I was following your advice. So long, and I think this is quite serious, and I think after this we'll get, I think, to the main, what I think is perhaps a fundamental element in your book, which is, I would say that it is an ode to reading. It is a love letter to reading, your book.
Yeah, it is.
Je voulais qu'elle vous le dise avant que je.
Of course.
Attendez, attendez. Ne parlez pas
evident.
De l'amour encore.
Okay.
So long. non, parce que là, avec les Français, on n'en termine pas. Hein. I mean, if the French begin talking about love, you know. I mean, we did speak about continence before. So long as reading is for us the inciter whose magic keys open to our innermost selves the doors of abodes into which we would not have known how to penetrate, its role in our life is salutary. C'est dur, hein,
afterwards, you will read a page of Ulysses by Joyce.
But that, no, but listen here, Bayard, you'll get this. But it's from Marcel Proust. But on the other hand, reading becomes dangerous. La lecture est dangereuse. When instead of waking us to the personal life of the spirit, it tends to substitute itself for it. When truth no longer appears to us as an ideal we can realize, only through the intimate progress of our thought and the effort of our heart, but as a material thing, deposited between the leaves of books like honey ready-made by others, and which we have only to take the trouble of reaching for on the shelves of libraries and then savoring passively in perfect repose of body and mind. Difficult?
Too long, I have already forgotten.
briefly stated, briefly stated here.
I think it's quite important. Many writers told that because there is a point where it's necessary to stop reading if you want to create.
And if you want to live.
Sometimes I tell to students who are writing a thesis now, you stop reading. Yes. Because you can stop read all your life.
No, I mean, I know it. My dissertation advisor one day said to me...
There is a moment when it's necessary to stop reading to
write.
Be a creator and to live, of course.
Because if not, you also live with everybody else in your head.
Of course.
Elementary, maybe, or what?
But Conan Doyle did not tell it.
My advisor once said to me, you know, there are two kinds of dissertation, brilliant dissertations and finished dissertations.
There are two types of dissertations, the dissertations brillantes and the dissertations finies.
But you do talk about that, Bayard, in your book, the fact that reading is dangerous if it substitutes itself for living. But you do say something that... that I find highly suspect, and which worries me a great deal. Let me find it. I know it worried me this morning. You say at the end of the book, just before the epilogue, before the epilogue, you say, beyond the possibility of self-discovery, the discussion of unread books places us at the heart of the creative process by leading us back to its source. To talk about unread books is to be present at the birth of the creative subject. In this inaugural moment when book and self separate, the reader free at last from the weight of the words of others may find the strength to invent his own text, and in that moment he becomes a writer himself. Mm-hmm. And tell me if I'm being too literal, but I mean, do we need more writers?
What I try to explain is about classes in school and universities. I think we don't have to form passive readers, but also readers who try to write and try to express themselves. Of course, just a little number will become real writers. But it's important to explain that to be... when you read on, it's exactly what I try to explain about book reports. I think to read is not to register such as a machine. It's to create little things, but to create. I think we should try to put our students in this position, you see. It does not mean everyone will become a writer, of course.
You're not encouraging that.
No, encouraging that.
It's not the problem. I don't have opinion about the number of books which are published. It's not what I try to explain. What I try to explain is to help people to find an own way, a creative way.
It's a matter of encouraging a practice.
Yeah, of course.
In the sense of Marx, in which everything should be a fisher, a hunter, and that. We understand and appreciate Pavarotti and Sinatra because we are able to sing every day when shaving at Winchester Cathedral. We're able to do that, and we have the right to do that. And there was a sort of idea that instead writing is reserved to a privileged minority, and you don't write. And so we had a lot of frustrated people then who try to write and then to send to the publisher to receive the manuscript back, to suffer. Now it has finished with the internet. Everybody can write. We don't read them, okay. But everybody has the right to write. Has the right to write and to practice. And that's good. That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
Yeah, it is for internet.
Huh?
He is for internet, yeah.
And you?
Yeah. Why not? Why not?
In closing, on page 129, you say something that I find quite moving. You say, to speak without shame about books we haven't read, we would thus do well to free ourselves of the oppressive image of cultural literacy without gaps, as transmitted and imposed by family and school, for we can strive towards the image for a lifetime without ever managing to coincide with it. No. Truth destined for others is less important than truthfulness to ourselves, something attainable only by those who free themselves from the obligation to seem cultivated, which tyrannizes us from within and prevents us from being ourselves. Là, vous parlez de la vérité de soi. Que la chose la plus importante, c'est la vérité de soi.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I forgot. I told it, but I think it's true. Yeah.
Now, what he's saying is that what I have written, please respect it, which is against your theory.
yeah, very much so.
The problem is.
Vous dites, j'écris ça, respectez-le, mais c'était contre votre.
But I had forgotten, I had written it, and so, and we had, we were lost, we had lost the page, and so I have discovered what I had told.
Now, as you read it, written by a stranger, obviously,
what,
how do you interpret that?
Oh, I think it's a good idea, yeah. you give me the page, I should like to read this passage.
Yes.
It seems interesting, yeah. Yeah. What does the writer want to say exactly?
I'm not sure. Thank you very much. There are mics on each side of the room. The room is a bit warmer, I think. And you will be able to ask questions. I will say that questions, unlike mine, can usually be asked in about a minute or less.
And followed by a question mark.
Followed by a question
mark. Not to be a statement.
Not a statement. I often say that. Please, if you could pass the mic over. Could we have the mic, please?
I wonder if we could have just a little discussion on beauty and ugliness.
We got wrong about the evening. It was 2 days ago.
Next year, when you, what is it, you're going to write a sequel maybe to Ugliness?
Since we said the ugliness is infinite, yes. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Please, let's get the mic.
Barbara, you have a question.
Just 1 second. If you could wait 1 second, we're recording.
Has either of you ever listened to a book on tape?
My answer, no. But many of my books are on tape. And I think they can be useful for commuters, blind people, and a lot of being not a commuter.
Not blind.
So I am not against, on the contrary, for.
I did not, but this book will be published under this form in Germany and United States. And I'm a difficult situation because I dislike there is a changement of one virgule. Virgule in a book, which is exactly the contrary of the position I have, because I teach it's necessary to scheme and transform books and improve. This concerns myself. I dislike if there is a one change, so I am in a schizophrenic position about this point.
I wonder, you talked about skimming books, which is very interesting. You didn't mention in the conversation, at least, about methods of skimming books. And I find one that I use very often. I wonder, what do you think about methods or orders? I think it's common. Many people do that, so I'm not unique. I would read some pages of the beginning, some pages of the end, and at random, one or two sections in between, and then I will decide either that I know enough about the book or don't want to know about the book, and we'll leave it, or I'll decide to read some sections more, and maybe at the end I will read it from beginning to an end, and that's rare.
No, there are different techniques of skimming, and they are depending on your needs, the context, if you're a scorer, if you are a normal reader,
how much time
for instance, I have, if you can use the index, index is an encouragement to skip. With internet, now you can decide if you are interested in all the pages in which your book speaks of cats. You call for cats and you skip, which is absolutely. Absolutely interesting. In my just published book on the turning the clock back, there is a chapter on how many times Dr. Watson remembered his adventures in Afghanistan. It's obvious. Before it would have been an ordeal. With internet, I picked up the entire work of Conan Doyle. I called for Afghanistan, and I found in a few minutes all the pages in which Dr. Watson was speaking of Afghanistan. Okay, that is a very correct way of using a book of scheming. So internet encourages scheming more than before.
But are you worried that Google might be not an accurate source of information?
Internet is an absolutely inaccurate source of information.
Yes.
That's another story. And we have to teach people how to criticize the internet, the web information. That's another story. But when the internal links in the Conan Doyle works tell me how many times Dr. Watson speaks of a guest, this is an accurate source of information. Why to despise it? It's more precise than an index in a book in which the editor always dropped something or made the wrong page and so on and so forth.
For me, skimming is not just jumping over pages. It's a kind of way of dreaming, a kind of promenade inside the books. You have many ways of skimming.
Also the transversal reading.
It's a way of living with books such as a companion. It's not only a technique to go further. It's a kind of liberation in comparison with what is taught in many schools. You see, it's just a technique of suppressing pages.
Yes. No, not only. You know that here in this country there are many classes in quick reading. And once Woody Allen said, I learned the quick reading, I read War and Peace, it speaks of Russia. Okay, but yes, there are many ways of going through a book, and so there is not a rule. No. Sometimes it's absolutely instinctive and artistic. It can be artistic. It can be an art.
I will be more precise in the next tome of this saga about this problem, and the next tome will be with a foreword by Umberto Eco.
Did you hear that?
Provided you have not read the tome, yes.
I'll shoot that question. I guess to your comment about the internet being kind of inaccurate at the moment. The internet as an inaccurate source of material at the moment. I mean, so much is digitized right now and becoming digitized in the future. My thought is, do you think the book is becoming a kind of a fetish item, something that's part of a personal library, but not necessary in a future in which books are increasingly more digitized and more available? My thought is, in the way that books are unlocked through skimming, books are also unlocked through searching. And I'm just wondering if you can comment on whether you feel the book is going really to be valid, in coming years.
The book will keep going. For oculistic reasons.
For which reasons?
What is the doctor curing the eyes? The ophthalmological reasons. You cannot read the Bible on the screen, entirely on your screen. Otherwise your eyes will become two tennis balls. And conjunctivitis will win. Therefore, the book will, even when Google will have digitalized everything, you ask for print on demand, you have your book and you go on your bed or in your bathroom and you read your book. And you read your book. Yes. Believe me. I'm living on that, so I am confident.
It's in your best interest to believe that.
I should make a distinction between books and texts. What should be for me a tragedy is a disparition of texts. perhaps books will change and adapt, but we are in a civilization where texts could disappear, and I think it should be the real disaster.
The distinction
because
is
it's not
quite
the same thing.
Familiar, books.
I have a little question, Pierre. I will tell you in French if you want, if it's
oui.
Easier. I think there is a very interesting cultural.
That's good French.
Alors je dis. Alors je. There is Pierre. Je te dis en français. Je te dis en
oui,
français.
Oui, oui, I will translate.
Je te dis. Non, en France, on a une tout à fait autre approche de la littérature au lycée qu'aux États-Unis. In France, we have a much bigger respect for the literary text as really religious, as you said. And in the United States, the student is much freer. L'étudiant est plus libre. For example, and I think you should write an American version of your book, Pierre. Tu devrais écrire une version anglaise, américaine. For example,
but it's
in
doing
the,
very well.
In
I
the
mean,
no.
I mean,
in
I
the
think
United,
I wouldn't change it.
For example, Pierre, in the United States, there is one discipline taught in universities, which is creative writing, that we don't have in France.
Do you
understand what I'm talking?
Yeah, of course, I know that. And c'est exactement à ça que je fais allusion quand je dis qu'il faudrait faire des créateurs. Perhaps you can translate
oui,
in the other sense.
We change.
Ça te dérange pas?
Non, non,
oui.
Non.
C'est exactement à ça que je fais allusion quand je dis qu'il faudrait faire des créateurs. Je suis dans un département universitaire en France. On est le seul département en France où il y a des activités de création.
This is exactly what I'm talking about when I say at the end of my book that I want people to write. And I'm in a department of literature in Paris, which is the only department where we teach creative writing, but it's very rare in France, it doesn't exist.
Et donc je sais qu'en Amérique du Nord c'est comme ça, et je trouve que c'est une très bonne chose. En France c'est quasiment impensable.
I know that that's the way it is in the United States, and I think it's a great thing. In France it's almost unthinkable.
Of how unreliable it is to rely on the internet, would you care to comment about relying on book reviews for knowing all about books?
Who are you asking, me or Pierre?
Either of you gentlemen.
Now, this is a country in which there are still good book reviews. I must admit, in France too. In Italy, books reviews are substituted more and more by interviews with the author, which are self-advertising, obviously, which is crazy. But there are many, many newspapers that say we don't make the book reviews review if you don't give first an interview. And after you have given the interview, they say it's useless to make the book review. So in Italy there is the absolute decline of the art of book reviewing. In this country, no. No, absolutely not.
But he was asking if you can rely on book reviews. I would say that in your case one can rely because the book reviews were
taste.
Very...
It's a matter of taste. When you write a book you can please 50% of your readers, and so the only solution is not to read the reviews of your books.
But in your case, Pierre, you would rely on the reviews of this book because they were very good.
Vous savez, on va continuer dans ce sens parce que vous savez, je crois qu'il faut être très compréhensif envers les critiques littéraires.
I think one has to be very understanding with literary critics, reviewers.
Pour faire une bonne critique, il faut arriver à rentrer dans l'univers de l'auteur.
To make a good review, one has to enter the author's.
Il serait nécessaire de lire tous les livres pour arriver à comprendre quel est l'univers imaginaire et linguistique qu'il a inventé.
One would have to read all the books he's read to understand his universe, to understand the world he recreates.
À l'université, on essaye de le faire, mais on a plus de temps et on est payé pour ça.
At universities, one can do this, but one has more time and one is paid to do that.
Moi, je ne peux pas trop me plaindre parce que les critiques ont fini par comprendre le type de livre que je faisais et qu'il y avait une dimension sérieuse et une dimension humoristique. Mais ça prend du temps, donc il faut comprendre aussi les critiques. C'est difficile.
In my book, critics understood that because they understood that there was part of it was serious and part of it was trying to be funny. But I was lucky because it takes time usually to understand the universe of a book.
Parler d'un seul livre comme ça, si on ne se plonge pas dans le projet de l'auteur, c'est impossible. Et souvent, ils sont obligés de parler d'un seul livre.
The difficulty is that critics often have to talk about only one book, when to understand one book, one has to enter a universe, one has to understand many other books.
And then, in certain countries, Italy is one, you feel compelled to speak of the book immediately after, if not, it's too late. Why sometime a good reviewer should need 6 months in order to understand the book, and once it was like that. It can happen like this still in the New York Review of Books, certain publications, but less and less people are compelled to speak immediately. So the poor reviewer is obliged to improvise.
No, I mean, they just came up with another translation of War and Peace. You can imagine, you know, reviewing that in for the next day's newspaper. It's not easy.
My book could be useful in this special case. Huh?
Buy it, yeah.
I was interested, did any of you read all the Harry Potter books? And if you could explain what the phenomenon of the Harry Potter books is.
I read them twice, but what about you?
Have you, Bruce? Have you heard about the Brothers Grimm? Okay. In every century, there were people writing fairy tales according to the spirit of that century. And now we have Harry Potter. What's wrong about that?
Have you read all of them?
Two. In order to understand that they were the same as Perrault, as Grimm, as Snow White, as I don't know, Little Red Riding Hood, or Pinocchio. So it's a normal magic literature for children. Okay. What's wrong?
I don't think anybody said anything was wrong. There's much made of
I
the fact
I prefer War and Peace, but that's
a question of taste.
Mes enfants ont 14 et 10 ans, alors je n'ai pas eu le choix. J'ai lu et je lis Harry Potter. Ce serait autrement trop grave pour ma situation dans la famille si je ne le faisais pas.
My children are 10 and 14, so I had to read Harry Potter, otherwise my situation in my position in the family would be very compromised.
One other thing, do you find it odd the first edition of Harry Potter sells for over $10,000?
Si vous trouvez que c'est bizarre que la première édition de Harry Potter, I don't know why I'm translating.
No, I était payé.
Que la première édition de Harry Potter se vend pour $10,000. Est-ce que vous trouvez que c'est bizarre?
Bruce, you are a rare books dealer. The fault is yours, not mine. If you overprice the first editions. Listen, you ask me, I don't buy from you the first edition of Harry Potter at that price. Bruce Raymer.
D'accord, donc c'est vraiment... Ah d'accord, mais moi je croyais que vous l'appeliez Bruce. I just thought you were saying Bruce.
They are responsible for making those
prices. Why do you price it so high?
Why did you price it?
I like Incunabula, 16th century books, that's 15th century books.
That's true. So you don't buy Harry Potter? Harry Potter. No. That's true.
I've never read a Harry Potter.
Nobody's perfect.
And I've never seen the movie.
So by his Incunabula and not Harry Potter. They cost only a few thousand dollars.
I believe that Umberto Eco wished to speak earlier this evening about the third part of the book of Pierre Bayard. So could we invite you to do that now?
No, I did it. The third part was a sort of indulgence shown by Bayard for a free reconstruction of books instead of reading them. And I said that sometimes for certain books it is indispensable to read them and to interpret that. That was the point. So we have dealt with that.
Bayard, the last point is yours now. I claim that, in fact, in my view, your book is a love letter to the reader and to reading. First of all, tell me if I'm right, and second of all, if I'm right, why?
D'abord, je voudrais répondre à la question là. J'ai envoyé quelques signaux de paix en tant que psychanalyste à la sémiologie pour que nous passions une soirée tranquille. Et c'est pour ça que nous n'avons pas trop débattu sur la troisième partie. Il y a une sorte d'accord en sous-main, un dogland treaty.
As a psychoanalyst, I've worked things out with Umberto Eco yesterday. As I sent peace signals, as Umberto Eco is a semiologist, we managed to find an agreement. So it was fine. The third part was.
Et en ce qui concerne ce que dit Paul, pour moi, ça me fait vraiment très très plaisir de dire cela, parce que certaines personnes ont pensé que c'était un livre contre la lecture, ce qui est stupide. En effet, c'est une lettre d'amour à la lecture.
I'm very pleased that Paul would say this, because of course some people thought I was against reading, and of course it is a love letter to reading.
Ce que j'essaye de dire aux jeunes, c'est venez vers les livres et soyez originaux dans les chemins que vous inventez vers les livres pour construire votre bibliothèque personnelle.
What I try to say to young people is find your way to books and invent your own way through these books, invent your own paths across literature.
Thank you so much.